Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of MPMA's Bug Bites. I'm one of the hosts of the show, Mike Bentley, and I'm joined today by my co-hosts,
Ellie Lane
and
Laura Rosenwald.
Awesome. And we are incredibly excited to be joined by a very special guest today, Emily Kendrick with Arrow Exterminators out of Atlanta, Georgia. Emily, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, guys. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, man. Thanks for being here. I can already tell this is going to be a fan favorite. It's from hosts, this is already one of our favorites. It's been a wild ride. Thanks to the magic of editing, we won't have to include all the other stuff that led up to this point. But it's been quite an episode so far, right?
It sure has.
So I know that we have had the chance to get to know you quite a bit over the years, but tell us a little bit about Arrow Exterminators, maybe how it got started. Were you guys always based out of Atlanta? Is that where it originally started?
Yeah, we sure were. So my grandparents, Mimi and Papa, my dad's parents, started Arrow 60 years ago. We're actually celebrating our 60th anniversary here in Atlanta, Georgia. And it's kind of hard to believe, but it started in the back of a beauty parlor a couple of miles from where our home campus is now. And people are always like, why was your grandmother, did she cut hair or something? No, not at all. She just had this big old beehive, like hairdo.
We'll add the drum sound effect in there later. Don't worry.
Could you? And she would go to the beauty parlor once a week. And, you know, she and my grandfather had started this pest control business and their carport. And they had it was a big cleaning closet in the back of this place. And she called it an office and she said, hey, can we rent it? So they had these termite guys going in and out of there the first year in business. And so that was in 1964. My dad came into business in 72 and really grew it from there. When my grandfather passed away in 1978, the business was doing $850,000. And our team of rock stars just surpassed 400 million. So it's been a wild ride. And we kind of feel like even though we're 60 years young, we're just getting started. So let's go.
Man,
that's awesome.
That is awesome. Gosh. Now, you know, there's one thing that I love about our industry, and that's so many pest control companies are family focused, they're people focused companies. But I will tell you, I mean, there's something special about Arrow and the way that it exemplifies how a company can invest in its people. Is that company culture focus been something that's been there for a long time? Was that something that grew over time, or was that just right out of the gate? That's just always been a pillar for Arrow.
Well, we were a family business, right? We started as a family business, and my grandparents were very keen and very passionate about creating a business that wasn't just like, hey, we're literally like blood related, although there are a lot of related people at Arrow, okay? But hey, we spend a lot of time at work doing what we love. And, you know, anybody who came to work at the company, I mean, from day one, was considered family, you know, and so even today, you know, with, you know, thousands of people now, that's kind of how we've always approached it. Now, some people I think are kind of like, ooh, that's a lot. Let me get this straight. You're my work family. And, you know, you toss that word around but that's just kind of how we've always looked at it. And as the company grew over the years, you know, my grandfather and then my dad was very big on not just, you know, hey, here's the job we do, but like, hey, how can we reward you? And he would do these fishing trips. And people still talk about the Crystal River, Florida fishing trips, which I think there were some big stories that came from those, you know. And as this is kind of random, but our 100th office ended up being where? In Crystal River, Florida.
No kidding.
Of all places. But anyway, they just always love to invest back into our folks from the get-go, whether it was for like incentive trips or, you know, doing trips or dinners or luncheons or family fun days. where, you know, people would bring their spouses and their kids in or Christmas parties. It was always about like everybody's families, and it just kind of grew over time. And, you know, to today, I mean, we are extremely intentional and have been for several decades now about our culture and investing back into our people. And it takes a lot of time and a lot of money and a lot of attention to staying true to our culture and investing back in our people. It's, I mean, if you sit here and are in our meetings and our get-togethers and our decisions day to day, you always hear us coming back to that. Because if you take your eye off it, I mean, for 1 minute and start to lose it, it's almost impossible to get back. It really is. So, you know, was it like, you know, their intention from the beginning? Gosh, they just went out and sold a pest control contract, you know, and then kind of built from there. But I think they just saw what worked, what the secret sauce was. And then we tried to emulate it over time. So.
Well, the work, you know, your organization puts into it certainly shows. I mean, it's any Aerotech member you talk to. I mean, that's just, you can tell in the way that they describe how, where they work and the folks they work with that, you know, that company culture and that family work family atmosphere is really something that's kind of.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate it. It's very intentional. And what I'll tell you is, you know, we try to keep it going, but it's really our folks who make it happen. They make it happen day in and day out. So I appreciate that.
Well, you certainly have an awesome team. So, you know, for folks that may have found their way into the pest control industry in one way or another, it's fun to hear how they got their first foot in the door in pest control. But you know, your family, it was what started the business. So I think I probably have a guess as to how you got into pest control. Your family was there. Was that always something that you knew that you were going to do, was be part of the pest control business? Or was this kind of much like a lot of other folks, you didn't think this was going to be it, but this is where you ended up?
Yeah. Whoopsie daisies. Here I am. No, I mean, I grew up around it. I grew up going to, you know, summer state association meetings and national association meetings and, you know, getting to know, you know, I knew we were at a bug meeting and there were a lot of fun other kids there my age. And, you know, I loved the people. People in our industry are awesome, always have been. And I still think they're some of the finest folks out there. But, no, I did not want to be in the bug business. Gross. I mean, so growing up, my dad always told me, you know, I was kind of a wild kid and a big personality and, you know, would try and argue every little point. And my grandmother, who was one of our founders, and my dad used to say, gosh, you should argue for a living, you know, and I'm like, an attorney. Yeah, definitely. I'm going to be an attorney, you know? And so I wanted to go to law school. And, so I guess it was around my junior year in college. I'd just taken a practice LSAT exam and, I'd also interned for our attorneys one summer. And I remember I went on a vacation and it was just my dad and I, my mom and sister were already there. My dad and I were traveling together and he started asking me kind of some probing questions about, you know, what kind of law do you want to, you know, this and that. And what came from the conversation, and now I look back at it, he was very intentional. He knew what he was doing. But at the time I thought it was just this one-off conversation. And what came from the conversation was, those people sure are miserable. And it was true. It was three attorneys in this practice. They never took a vacation. They were at the office late every night. They just were like, they just seemed miserable. And my dad's like, well, you know, the company keeps going while I'm on vacation. They go on vacation, the business stops, you know? And he would just make these comments. And he's like, are you sure you don't want to just like, give it a go, you know, you don't have to stay, you know, you might find you like it. And he said, you know, you're great with people and it's a people business. He's like, the bugs, that's like, that's what we do. Okay. And we're really good at it, but it's a people business. And he kind of a little bit tricked me into it, and I fell in love with it. It really did. It's like I came in, and after a couple of months, it's like somebody just like put a shot in my arm without me knowing. And it was just a part of me. And I fell in love with it. And it was a whoopsie daisies. I never thought I'd be in the bug business. I
but
really
you were
didn't.
Bitten by the bug.
Boom, chicka bound, boom.
That's
you're on fire true. Today, Mike Bentley.
I'm telling you, that's two. And it only gets worse from
bless
here.
Bless his heart, guys, Laura and Ellie. Do you say that often? Bless his heart.
No, you, Laura,
yeah,
Laura,
but maybe like in the bless his heart kind of way,
well,
the Midwest kind of way, not the Southern kind of way.
Okay, anytime you say bless your heart or bless his heart or her heart, it's kind of a yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I'm well aware. I hear it a lot. Oh man.
Okay.
Well, and you stay pretty busy too. So when you're not busy running Arrow, you also give back to the industry in a whole host of other ways, including your service leadership with the National Pest Management Association. Is that right?
Yeah, I love it. I absolutely love it. I've, you know, been involved in various ways with NPMA for years. And a couple of years ago, I was asked to step up and serve on the executive committee. And I think my first question was, are you sure you want me? I'm not sure you want me. But no, I was honored to be asked and considered. And man, I thought I knew a lot of people in the industry. And in just the last few years, I've met so many more. And you know, many years ago, I was one of, you know, I was kind of young person in the industry. And now all of a sudden I'm like in the middle part or later middle part of it. And there's this like whole group of young people coming through, and it's been awesome. I've really enjoyed it. And I continue to enjoy it. It's fantastic. Y'all have always had such a great team at NPMA. I mean, for decades now. But I think y'all might have the finest team I've ever seen at any association right now. It's just so strong. It really is.
Well, really appreciate that. I mean, half of the fun of what we do is getting to work with awesome folks like you.
Yeah. And
really excited to have you on the executive committee. I think it's a great fit. And yeah, everything you've done for the industry, just such a great way to be able to kind of continue that. So really excited to have you.
Making me blush.
Well, and I'll tell you too, you're still part of the young group. Don't let these other folks tell you otherwise.
Bless your heart.
Still part of the young group.
Bless your heart.
Can we have a bless your heart counter for this episode? Just
I feel like
you know what I think we should do? I should go in and bleep it every time she says it.
Like, man, that was a vulgar episode.
I know, yeah. There's a lot of man, Emily just bleeping left and right. That's crazy.
I mean, do you ever say things, and this probably happens to you, Mike, or you say things and you either think to yourself or say out loud, bless my heart.
Oh, all the time on the podcast, and I just edit it out later, so no one else has to hear me say it. Oh man, well, we were talking before this, and you know, we really appreciate you being on the show. As is with most of our guests, you kind of have no idea what you're getting into, and that's exactly how we like it. Because I think if you knew what we were about to do, you probably wouldn't have wanted to sign on. But so
I'm
what we're
sure
going to do is we're going to play a fun game. So Ellie's going to kind of explain to us the rules of the game. The rules of engagement, so to speak, and how it's going to work over the next 15 to 20-ish minutes, and then we'll go from there. That sound good?
Sounds great.
All right, awesome.
All right,
I
love games.
All right, so in case you aren't familiar with the rules of the game and what we're about to subject you to, here's a quick little summary. So each of us is going to take about 5 minutes to review our favorite science discovery or news article from the past couple months. And after each of us finishes our summary, we're going to pause for questions and discussion about the article so you can ask us things and we can talk about it a little bit and then keep going through the next ones. And at the end of that, you're going to get to pick who you think did the best job covering their article. So you can decide that by any metric you want. We do take some good attention to timing of this. So we'll there could be points taken off for going over time.
I got a timer right here.
But does that all make sense?
Makes complete sense. So what you're telling me is the nerd herd is in the house.
That's
and
right.
Oh, you're going to each present to me. I love it.
We prefer the term brain train. Thank you.
do we?
As you do.
No, they, maybe I just prefer the term brain train.
I knew there was a big brain in that big head of yours.
It's mostly empty space, as I can attest. I promise you that. And you're going to find out pretty soon after I go through this.
So, well, Mike, he last episode ended up winning. So as we have it set up, that means that he goes first in our order today, and then I'll go, and then Laura will go last. So that's going to be our order of operations here. And Mike,
take notes.
I know, well, yeah. Mike, when you're ready, you can take it away.
All right. So,
okay. First note, lame.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Lame.
No,
lame
Mike going first. No, keep going with that, Emily.
Yeah.
No, you've got it. This
start
is right.
Now. No, you're on the timer.
Emily, I feel obligated to tell you, though, you are in between Mike and him winning what I'm affectionately calling the Triple Crown, because he's won the past two episodes that we've had. So thank you. That's for those listening.
Look here. First off, I think this is cheating to say that, because now you've instantly biased the judge. And for everybody that couldn't see her on screen, she just gagged off screen. So I what I was going to say was that we are, while we may seem like strong, tough entomologists on the exterior, we do bruise like a peach on the inside. So when you make your final decision, we ask that you crown the winner, but you don't have to say who's second and third place. We are sensitive, delicate folks. Feel free to ask any questions you want to after our summary's up. And what we always do is we start by reading the title of the paper that we're going to cover. And we don't start the timer until after we've read the title, because sometimes the titles are pretty long. Okay.
Sometimes your guests interrupt you. Okay. I understand. I can do it. I'm not going to interrupt. And once you read your title, I'm going to start my timer.
I am very intimidated right now.
Good.
Okay. All right. The paper that I'm going to struggle through today, I apologize to the authors. I suddenly feel very unconfident right now. Laura. All right. So the title.
I use whatever means I can.
No, this is very dirty. I'm telling you right now. All right. Title of my paper that I'm going to be covering today is Oral Toxicity of an Artificial Sweetener, Sucralose, on the German Cockroach and Its Impact on Water Balance and Gut Microbiome.
Oh, wow.
All right.
That's gonna be amazing.
So this paper was conducted by a handful of researchers, Sue et al., out of the University of California, Riverside. The German cockroach is one of those age-old pests that we've been battling for what feels like forever. And as is the case with most of our classic urban pests, they've been well studied, which means that any new discoveries for these pests are typically few and far between, which is what makes my paper so exciting today. So we're in a never-ending battle, essentially, with trying to find the next silver bullet for German cockroaches. Researchers are constantly searching for novel active ingredients or ways to improve existing control tools and methods in order to tip the scales in our favor of this never-ending war against this public health pest. Now, one particular challenge when managing German cockroaches is the infestations are typically found in sensitive environments, places like kitchens, food storage areas, and other living spaces where treatment options may be relatively limited because of the sensitive nature of those areas. Now, in an effort to find new toxicants that would be safer in these environments, toxicologists have been exploring the use of some what are considered classified as generally recognized as safe compounds, such as artificial sweeteners, as possible insecticides for pest management. Now, artificial sweeteners are just what you're thinking, the stuff that comes out of the blue pack, the pink pack, or the yellow packet. These are typically used to sweeten your morning beverage like coffee or tea. Now, some of these common artificial sweeteners that have been looked at in the past include sorbitol, xylitol, saccharin, aspartame, and sucralose. Now, past studies have tested the potential toxicity of artificial sweeteners on a whole range of pests, and they've had pretty mixed results, ranging from changes in motor function, decreased response to the opposite sex, reduced feeding, dehydration, and even reduced survival. And until recently, there have been pretty limited testing results on artificial sweeteners and their toxicity to cockroaches, which brings us to today's paper by Sue and colleagues. In this publication, the researchers investigated the oral toxicity of sucralose on the German cockroach. And to do this, they ran three separate experiments. Now, in all three of these experiments, they compared feeding results or effects of with the sucralose using two separate types of populations. One was what they called a susceptible type. That strain of population means that it was reared in the lab for a really long time, which means that those cockroaches were kept free from any pesticide exposure, and therefore they've never had the ability to develop most known mechanisms of resistance to contact for common insecticides. So they would be susceptible to dying at really low doses, to exposure to pretty much anything out there. Then the second group was an insecticide resistant population. So resistant and non-resistant populations for each experiment. In the first experiment, they assessed the oral toxicity of sucralose. So they fed both susceptible and resistant strains on sucralose at three different concentrations, 5, 10, and 20%. What they found, unsurprisingly, was that 20% concentration had the highest mortality rate, ranging from 62.5% to 92.5%, whereas the 5% only had about 2.5% to 27.5% mortality. So higher mortality at 20%, but registering mortality overall, which is great. The second experiment, they looked at the impact of water loss when they fed both strains of cockroaches at 20%, so the highest percentage concentration. And what they found was that all strains lost between 23 and 30% body water over after 6 days when fed that 20% sucralose. So second experiment determined if there was any measurable dehydration, and there was in fact dehydration. In the last experiment, they looked at gut bacterial composition after both strains were fed 20% sucralose. And what they found was that the diversity of gut bacteria was significantly reduced after 3 days after being fed the 20% sucralose or 20% concentration. So in conclusion, the German cockroaches fed 20% sucralose solution had a higher mortality than lower concentrations. They were more dehydrated, and they had a decreased diversity of gut bacteria. And overall, these results are pretty promising, given the impacts that sucralose has on dehydration and gut microbiome and its palatability to German cockroaches. This artificial sweetener could be an important additive that could potentially enhance the toxicity of existing baits or possibly be even being used as a standalone ingredient. However, it is important to note that this was a laboratory study where the cockroaches were not given other food choices to select from. So it's possible that they may not readily consume this sucralose when other competing food sources are available, or maybe not. We just don't know yet because they didn't test it. And there's still a lot of unknowns to give us a full clear picture of what's internally going on inside the cockroach with the gut microbiome diversity piece. Nevertheless, this does show promise, and I expect that we'll see more follow-up studies on this in the near future. 9 seconds over. Ish. I think. Ish.
Yeah, it's about 5 minutes.
Close.
Yeah, five-ish minutes.
I'm like an ish, a titch type person, so basically 5 minutes.
I can see the disappointment on Emily's face already. I can already see where this is. I'll show myself out. You guys
you
can.
You know what? All I was thinking about was my xylitol gum, my sugarless gum. I was just thinking about myself, to be honest. And like, I'm killing myself.
No. So that's.
Because, you know, artificial sweeteners are really bad for you.
They certainly
can. They just are.
Yeah. And I say they certainly can be. I don't know. I mean, I think that, you know, the dose makes the poison kind of thing. I mean, what we do know is that this stuff is safe enough to put in foods and in the quantities that we're consuming, you know, compared to some other products that could be used for control. Certainly an artificial sweetener would be a more preferential control tool in a food handling space, for example.
Yeah.
So when we talk about these sensitive environments,
it's really interesting.
All sorts of cool stuff going on right now and trying to figure out what may be the next control solution for stuff like this, anything that's in these food handling spaces. So yeah, I'm not singing the praises of artificial sweeteners. I'm also not saying that they're gonna kill people.
I don't think they're good for us. I mean, I'm just saying. I really don't, but we don't have to get into that.
Yeah. I mean, ice cream is not good for me if I eat a lot of it.
Fair. Yeah. We don't have to, let's not go down this road right now. I mean, but the thing is with ice cream, I mean, it's like just a couple of ingredients, right? It doesn't necessarily have to have like artificial sweetener. But anyway,
yeah.
Do you know, have they done any work where they do this with not in the lab, you know, where they're just outside playing around with this stuff?
So
I think it's so interesting.
Yeah, I as far as I know, I don't know of work that's been done outside of the lab yet in doing this. So a lot of times this is, you know, they start with stuff in the lab because they can control the environment. Sure. So I think with sucralose, this was initially to assess even if there's any toxicity, any mortality at all. Will they even eat it?
Yeah.
Assume that they probably would. I think the hypothesis here was that they would, because a lot of these, you know, potential artificial sweeteners could be used as, products to potentially enhance baits and palatability kind of stuff. But it's really interesting, you know, a lot of the arthropods that we try to control don't have. They process sweets differently than us. So attraction to sweets is similar, but the way that they process sweets, the way that they determine, you know, sugar versus an artificial sweetener may be the exact same. They think that they're the same. So in terms of increasing palatability, it may be no different. Whereas we could typically tell if we're using sugar in something versus, you know, an artificial sweetener often has a very distinct taste to us. So the way that we can determine artificial sweeteners is much different than arthropods. And a lot of times they just don't have that.
When was the article published?
This was published recently, but I think it was, let me see here. That's a great question. Let me look this up. I want to say 2000. Publication date is, standby, November 20th, 2023.
Okay. Well done, Mike.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I guess that puts me up next.
Yeah.
So I'll break out the old timer here. So so this paper that I'm going to talk about is actually the main author was Simona Principato, who was one of our Pest World interns for a couple of Pest Worlds ago. And she also received some of our scholarships through the Pest Management Foundation. So this is some of her research, which I thought was kind of cool to find a recent article from her, as well as some of her other colleagues. So the title of this is Histamine Excretion in Common Indoor and Hematophagous Arthropods. So histamine is involved in allergic reactions. So it's the biogenic amine, and that big fancy word for our purposes is just, it modulates the human and mammal immune response. Now, histamine is in a whole bunch of stuff, including foods we eat, and when it comes in contact with certain receptors, and for certain people, it can cause allergic reactions. So what does this have to do with bed bugs? Well, bed bugs actually excrete histamine in their feces. And the reason they do this is it serves this purpose as a part of their aggregation pheromone. And the histamine is their like stop here sign for fellow bed bugs. And we call that an arrestant. Now, what we didn't know is if other household pests or other blood feeding insects also produce histamine, or if it's just closely related insects to bed bugs that produce the histamine. The researchers wanted to know if histamine production was related to blood feeding, which the fancy word for that is hematophagy. Hematophagous is blood feeding, basically. Now, what they did in this study is they took a look at 22 species of arthropods to determine the presence and production of histamine in their excretions. So the species were grouped into three main categories. So we had common indoor pests, which included things like some cockroach species, termites, flies, beetles, moths, mites, common indoor pests. And then we had blood feeding species, so mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, and specifically blood feeding hemipterans. So of the same order as bed bugs, we also had bat bugs, kissing bugs, and our main guy, the bed bug. Now, they also looked at a non-blood feeding hemipteran, the stink bug that you're probably familiar with. So they reared all of these species in lab conditions according to best practices. They fed the blood feeding species on lab alternatives or animal blood. They weren't feeding them on themselves. But after rearing up enough adults or nymphs, they went to determine the histamine presence. So they took swabs and they sampled the substrate that these guys were living in and that they're being reared in. And they tested it using a process called gas chromatography, mass spectrometry, that's a big word, which is called GCMS. And basically, it's a whole complex process that tells you what is in a sample, what chemicals are inside what we're looking at. The whole process is a little bit beyond me, but if histamine was detected in the samples, then they would continue further testing with that species. Now, histamine was found at all only in 5 of those 22 species that they looked at. Now, these 5 species that it was present at all were the bedbug, the tropical bedbug, the bat bug, and 2 kissing bugs. The bugs were not kissing. This was 2 species of kissing bugs. And these are all blood-feeding hemipterans. So the important thing, too, is that no other blood-feeding insects were found to have the histamine. So mosquitoes, ticks, fleas were not. So they continued on, and they tested, they starved these arthropods that they knew had histamines and then put them in individual tubes, so 1 bug per tube, and then fed them again so they had completely fresh material in their diet. And they weighed them before and after feeding to see how much blood was being consumed. And then they sampled those tubes to collect their the feces, and then ran them through that analysis process again. And that showed how much histamine was being produced per bug, per day, per amount of blood that they had fed on. So they saw there was a strong positive linear correlation between amount of blood consumed and amount of histamines excreted. So they drank more blood, they excreted more histamines. But they also knew that blood itself wasn't what was causing the histamines because those other blood-feeding insects didn't have it. So then they also knew that it wasn't just hemipterans in general, because the stink bug, which didn't feed on blood, did not produce any histamines either. They hypothesized basically that histamine was introduced to the bugs by the blood, but that usually they get broken down by some sort of enzyme in the other bugs that these blood-feeding hemipterans didn't happen to have. So bed bugs are proportionately produce more histamines than the other hematophagous hemipterans. Try saying that 5 times fast. And it turns out that those are the only group of common indoor pests in general that even produce histamines, which are, of course, allergens and a public health concern. I went a little bit over time. I just got really excited about it. There we go.
It was basically 5 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I appreciate
it. It was basically 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Well done, Ellie.
Thank you.
That's interesting. More blood, more histamine. Mm-hmm. However, that's just really interesting. What was her name again?
Simona Principato. She's over at the University of Kentucky.
Oh, okay. She's over at Kentucky. That's
go
awesome.
Cats.
Oh boy.
I'm about to start
a fight on this podcast.
Oh yeah.
So interestingly, the Tennessee Vols, which are like my adopted college team, cause I went to Vanderbilt and we don't really do anything there. Athletically, but the rest of my family went to Tennessee. Didn't they just beat the Cats?
Listen, also Florida just beat the Cats too, and I am trying not to think about it. So anyway.
No, great job, Ellie. Great job.
All right, Laura, you ready?
Okay. Yeah, let me get my timer all set up. Okay.
Your horn app ready.
Laura, what are you going to talk to me about? Bow, bow, bow. Talk to me, Goose.
So today I'm actually going to be talking about ticks. This paper that I found came out in January of 2024, out of Yale and the University of Pennsylvania. So this is from Jacqueline Matias and colleagues, but my paper title today is mRNA Vaccination of Rabbits Alters the Fecundity, but Not the Attachment of Adult Ixodes Scapularis. Ixodes scapularis, or more commonly known as the deer tick or the black-legged tick, can act as a vector for several different diseases. However, it is probably most known as the main vector for Lyme disease, which is currently the most common vector-borne disease in the United States. Deer ticks obtain and spread diseases by feeding on the blood of several different vertebrates across the course of their lifetimes, including mammals, birds, and reptiles. Their feeding habits, along with the dramatic expansion of their distribution across the eastern half of North America in the past 50 years, make deer ticks a top concern as a public health pest. When these ticks feed, they release a series of molecules in their salivary glands that assist them in feeding. That's right, y'all. Today, we're talking about tick spit. These molecules are proteins that are known as tick salivary proteins and assist the tick in feeding by hindering the immune system of the host. However, some of these tick salivary proteins actually do the opposite in some vertebrate hosts and create an immune response called acquired tick resistance. Ticks that feed on a host with acquired tick resistance have diminished feeding and often detach from their hosts earlier than expected, which can have a huge effect on their ability to survive and reproduce. A recent study revealed that a lipid nanoparticle, which codes for 19 of these tick salivary proteins, is responsible for inducing this acquired tick resistance. This study took the lipid nanoparticle that coded for these 19 tick salivary proteins and created an mRNA vaccine. One group of rabbits received 3 doses of the vaccine given at 4-week intervals. Another group of rabbits received a control version of the mRNA vaccine. After 2 weeks, the rabbits were checked for antibodies. This was to ensure that the vaccine worked as it should and induced the correct immune response that would lead to acquired tick resistance. A week following the antibody check, the rabbits were then exposed to 50 adult deer ticks. The researchers did so in perhaps my favorite line ever from a science article, quote, "All the rabbits wore Elizabethan collars, and the ear that received the tick was isolated with an adapted sock, which prevented the ticks from moving to another location," unquote. Fashion aside, the rabbits were monitored daily for any signs of host rejection by the tick in time of tick detachment. Once detached, the ticks were weighed as a measure of how well they were able to feed on a host. Female deer ticks were further monitored for their egg masses, where the researchers examined the size of the egg mass, as well as how many of those eggs ended up hatching. Overall, the researchers found that there was no difference in the ways that ticks fed based on whether a rabbit was vaccinated. Both time of attachment and tick weight did not differ between the vaccinated rabbits and the control rabbits. Similarly, there wasn't a difference in the number of eggs laid when comparing ticks that fed on vaccinated rabbits versus the control rabbits. However, there was a significant difference in the percent of eggs that hatched from the vaccinated rabbits versus the control rabbits. These results suggest that the vaccine for the tick salivary proteins in rabbits can significantly impair how well deer ticks are able to reproduce. While this is just one experiment with one species, it is important to note that every new methodology for management of a pest starts somewhere. This study is extremely promising for its potential for reducing tick populations by simply giving a vertebrate host a vaccine over the course of a few short weeks. In addition, acquired tick resistance has not only been documented in rabbits, but also has been documented in several animals, including guinea pigs, dogs, and cattle. Eventually, it could be just as easy as having your livestock or pet vaccinated by your veterinarian to help reduce tick populations in your area. And I was early.
Wow. Wow.
Sweet.
You're pretty, like, you were early, early. Nice.
I was early.
How amazing.
I was just happy to give a TikTok.
I get it. I get it.
Thank you.
I never get old.
No,
add in another drum. There, Mike.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Going to be a lot of sound effects in this.
There's going to be a lot of side effects or sound effects.
There's going to be side effects after this. Yeah.
No, that was fantastic. Like my timer's just going off now. Wow. Oh, she wins. I mean.
Yeah.
Damn it. Wait a minute.
No, I'm just kidding. But wouldn't, I mean, I don't know about y'all, but I have several friends who struggle, have struggled, three different friends who have struggled with Lyme disease since their, one was like early 20s and then two were late 20s. And like forever, they didn't know what was wrong. I mean, month after month, do they know anything yet? Do they know anything yet? You know, and finally it was, they were diagnosed with Lyme disease and it's horribly debilitating. I mean, anything that can, you know, further that research. But wouldn't it be amazing one day if there was like a vaccination for Lyme disease? I mean, it's, I don't know if you guys have any friends who have had the same issue. I thought it was amazing that I know three people just like that who struggle with Lyme disease.
My dad had Lyme disease pretty bad when I was really little. It was like at least 20 years ago, but nobody really knew anything about it. So it took him forever to get diagnosed and they went through all these procedures. I mean, he's fine now pretty much, but it was quite a process. I remember a lot of summers in hospitals when I was really little.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But really cool paper. That was really interesting. So they've just did this article on the deer tick only. Did they mention they're like going to go and do this on other species of ticks or on other animals? Did they mention like possible next steps?
Yeah, so they were, the paper before this one from that same group actually was looking at the same vaccine, but in guinea pigs to actually just see if the vaccine would work at all. And interestingly, in guinea pigs, it seemed like the attachment differed, time differed, but it didn't differ in rabbits for whatever reason. So clearly there's some host effects that play into how successful the vaccine might be. But, you know, like I said, this sounds like very, very first steps, and they're probably going to try and expand or, you know, maybe perfect the vaccine a little bit because, you know, it's not always ideal to have multiple vaccines that you have to come back for and get multiple times, and no one wants to get shot in the arm multiple times either. So, or watch your pet or something get shot in the arm multiple times because, you know, even... It's even harder sometimes, I feel like, to bring your dog to the veterinarian than bring yourself to the doctor.
Seriously. Well, I think all three of y'all did an awesome job. Well done.
Oh, thank you. Head, baby. Good job, everybody.
I think y'all did a fantastic job.
Well, now's the hard part. I mean, the easy part's over for us. It's if it's by who got closest without going under 5 minutes. I mean, I think that award's...
What is this? Closest without going under?
Well, I mean, yeah, if you shortchange the 5 minutes, I mean, it's I don't know, that seems like a pretty...
Why are we changing the rules now?
Because I'm looking for ways to benefit myself personally. What do you mean?
Yeah. So he's out. So I mean, gun to my head, I mean, in my world, I think all three of you did a great job. Three different topics, really, really interesting. Actually, would love to learn more about all three. I would say all three of you, but I mean, you've got a gun to my head, so I got to pick one, and I'm going to go with Laura on the tick. So congratulations.
Congratulations.
Oh, look at Mike Bentley. He just took his toys and went home. Bless his heart.
No, wait for it. He'll be back. I can like hear him running past.
Mike is placing the crown on Laura's head. So this is a crown that travels.
Right? It is. Well, yes. it had traveled the last couple weeks.
Also, okay. Oh my God. I don't know how Mike wore this before because it's so uncomfy.
But did that fit on his head? Because I mean,
how did that fit on your head?
Has a big head. I mean,
no one said it was easy to wear the crown, Laura.
Your head just got so much bigger. I mean,
maybe that's what it is.
Your head just so big right now for the crown. Congratulations.
I appreciate all three of you. I just thought these were, I mean, to be quite honest, when I came on here, I was like, oh, this is going to be fun listening to bug research. I mean, I know I'm supposed to love that, but you know, it's not my thing. But it was actually really interesting. All three were really interesting. So well done.
Awesome. Well, hopefully you had as much fun as we did. So I'm not going to lie. This was an absolute blast.
I had an absolute blast with this. Like Monday afternoon, you know, normally Monday afternoon, you're like, oh, wow, it's just the end of the day. Oh, man, it's just Monday. But no, I had a hell of a good time. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much for agreeing to be on. This was great. And congrats, Laura. Ellie did an awesome job, too. This was a great way to start.
All three of y'all crushed it.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Nerd herd in the house.
Can that please be the actual description of this podcast? The nerd herd is back.
I know that this is great.
You're welcome.
Yeah, we'll pay you all the royalties. Don't worry.
You're welcome.
Well, we really appreciate you being on, Emily. This was a blast for us, and I'm glad you enjoyed it too. And certainly look forward to having you on again soon. So,
hey, thanks again. Love you guys. Y'all are awesome.
All right, see ya. All right, well, that's a wrap for another episode of MPMA's Bug Bites.
If you're interested in hearing more about any of the research we cover on the podcast, be sure to check out our pestology blog. You can find the blog at mpmapestology.com, and we'll also have a link in the description of this podcast.
And be sure to like and rate the podcast, leave feedback if you have any, and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss the release of a new episode. Thanks for listening.
NPMA Bug Bites is the industry source for the latest in science news and pest control research. It's brought to you by the National Pest Management Association. You can find links to the science discussed in this episode, as well as technical and business resources, training opportunities, and information about careers in pest control by visiting npmapestworld.org.